It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And lots to cover in just a short 29 minutes, so let's dive
in. As opposed to the long, drawn-out 29 minutes.
No, the long, drawn-out 30 minutes when we start a minute earlier. All right, starting with local and some new neighborhood groups.
Yeah, there are a couple of neighborhoods in this city who are not very happy with the city's plans to redevelop their areas, and so they decided to form their own neighborhood groups.
As opposed to whose? Who owns the previous neighborhood groups?
Yes, as an alternative to the existing so-called neighborhood groups that the city's negotiating with. In the case of South Lake Union, it's the South Lake Union Friends and Neighbors group that seems to represent mostly large businesses in the neighborhood and has only one resident that sits on
and developers
on it.
Yeah
and the new group in South Lake Union is Lake Union Opportunity Alliance, which has mostly residences and smaller local business owners on it, and they're pretty unhappy with the city's new height limits that raised the heights for South Lake Union. That proposed to raise the heights for South Lake Union up to 40 stories for what they call pin towers. And so there are a lot of residents in the South Lake Union area that are pretty mad about that. And so they formed their own alliance. The Southeast District neighborhood, the Southeast District Council is split into two now. There's a new Southeast District Neighborhood Council, which is composed of residences and business owners who are unhappy that the city uses the Southeast District as a dumping ground for most of its social services. And they're saying, look, you know, let the North End take some of the city's social services. Why do we have to get it all? And by the way, couldn't you give us a few more other services like new sidewalks, retiming traffic lights, et cetera, some of the things you're doing for North Seattle that you're not doing for us. So I think that's a good development.
All right. Well,
although it's fair also to point out that a lot of the movement in the South End that opposes social services being cited there is from a lot of relatively new residents that are starting to gentrify the area who, in some cases, are objecting to social services that have been there for a long time that are you know, treating, I mean, not everything is, but there's some tension between old time residents and newer residents in Southeast Seattle too. So you have to
it
doesn't break out strictly along those lines. I'm just saying you have to be careful about somebody claiming to represent the entire neighborhood because there's different factions down there.
Yeah, no, and that's pretty clear, but. I don't think it breaks out easily along those lines.
No,
and,
it doesn't.
And they have a point, really. I mean, the city has been spending a lot of money trying to redevelop South Lake Union and neighborhoods like Ballard
yes.
and Lake City, and for years has been ignoring what we might consider the poorer or more disadvantaged neighborhoods in the south part of the city, from Rainier Valley down to Mount Baker. And it may be time that they speak up a little more and get the city to acknowledge that you got to treat all your neighborhoods equally.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Plastic bags, are they in our future?
Yeah, the city's proposed...
No.
Well, the city's proposed plastic bag fee passed the committee vote this week and is headed for the full council vote on Monday. That's good news. What kind of irks me is that I keep seeing in the Seattle Times and hearing from other media sources this constant moaning from I think it's mostly large grocery stores that are doing this, but they keep portraying it as, oh, you know, what are poor people going to do if they have to go to the grocery store and pay more for their groceries because they have to pay a plastic bag fee? And all I have to say to that is, you know, they could do what I do, which is you get your own bags and you take them to the store. It is not that hard to do.
Yeah, and in 3 years, we're going to look back at this as much fuss about nothing because people are going to take it for granted the way they take recycling for granted now. That being said, and we'll talk about the light rail measure in a second, that I do think there's going to be some kickback to the fact that there are a number of different new taxes and bonds and money measures on the ballot this fall, and all of them individually are defensible, but when you take them up as a whole, there's going to be some pushback to that. because it is a relatively poor economy, and because there have been a number of money measures already on the ballot that have been approved the last few years.
We'll see how voters respond.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these things are we'll see how they prioritize them, what passes and what doesn't, what they think it's okay to spend money for and what they think is something that has to wait.
Yeah, and this is why you put them on the ballot, is to find out what people want to prioritize.
Yeah. And hopefully if some of them are defeated, some of these good issues sound transit, for example, that it won't completely discourage sound transit's planners from putting a new issue on the ballot when the economy improves. We'll see.
Well, with sound transit, I think it's just going to go on the ballot every year until
it passes.
Until the price of gas raises enough that people change their minds.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, you mentioned sound transit, so you might as well expand on that.
Talk a little bit more. Yeah, sound transit put their proposal for an expansion of light rail on the ballot for this November. I have the info right here. It's a large plan. It's about $17.9 billion. To extend light rail north to Linwood and south to Federal Way, and extend it east to Overlake to serve Microsoft primarily, I think. What's interesting to me about all this is the kind of the blowback in the media now, the pushback on that, saying, you know, oh, this is a bad time to announce a big plan like this. People don't have the money to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. The Seattle Times came out with an editorial. The headline was "Light Rail Can Wait." Ron Sims voted against it in the Tri-County panel that was voting on the Sound Transit plan to put it on the ballot. He was actually the only one,
and this is particularly significant because initially it was thought they only needed a 2/3 majority in order to pass it. But I was having a conversation with Ken Ladenburg, who is the Pierce County executive, who's I believe he's the chair of that panel. He's also running for attorney general against Rob McKenna, but he was considered one of the several no votes, and he was saying that he didn't feel that the measure should go to the ballot until it had at least 15 of the 18 votes, and it turned out to get 17 of the 18. And all of the votes from Pierce and Snohomish County, which were originally considered to be very skeptical toward the Sound Transit plan, because they're not initially going to see the benefits from it. That's farther down the road when light rail expands to Pierce and Snohomish County.
The plan does include some things for them, like expanded bus service to Everett and so
forth. It does.
But
the concern was that they go back to their constituents, because these are all elected officials, who are going to say, why are we paying for King County's transit? Well, it turns out that they were all eventually sold on the utility of light rail and the fact that the timing does need to be now. Ron Sims, who came out against Prop 1 last year ostensibly because it also included the road building, has now come out against it saying he wants expanded bus service, as though you can only do one or the other.
Well,
and,
he also said
he's been very, very isolated on this.
He also said back last fall that light rail is too expensive for what you get. Well, no, that's wrong. You know, I mean, back in the fall
that would explain why virtually every other of the top 50 cities in the country has it.
Yeah. Back in the fall when I said, you know, people should vote against Proposition 1, it was because it included those miles and miles and miles of new pavement. And I said, look, these should be separate plans. You should be able to vote on the pavement portion as one proposition, and you should be able to vote on the rail portion as a different proposition. And here we have the rail portion on the ballot, and so I support that. I mean, you got to have it. We got to have it eventually. It has to be built, and the sooner the better.
And I will admit that I was wrong. I was sort of lukewarm in support of Proposition 1, specifically because I didn't believe they would put it back on the ballot as a rail-only package this year, and they've done that, and I'm very pleased to have seen that happen.
Yeah, and I think it's a response to the higher gas prices.
Very much so. Well, not just the higher gas prices, but people's response to the higher gas prices, which is that transit is booming and traffic is down. There's clearly a demand for this.
Yeah, there's definitely a demand for it. And Ron Sims is setting himself up as, well, no, you know, we need buses instead. Well, the problem with that scenario is, in fact, we need both buses and the light rail plan. And Sims is looking at it very narrowly from his position as King County executive in charge of a budget that's going to see a shortfall this year. And, of course, it's King County that primarily funds Metro. And Metro is, they saw the budget shortfall and they said, oh, my God, we're set to do a local bus expansion, and we're going to see that done this year, but there's no money there for further expansions, which we're going to need if ridership keeps going up. So that's, but that's a very narrow look at it. You know, yeah, there's a limited amount of money locally to pay for transit, but that doesn't mean that you can't find dollars elsewhere for Metro, or you can't find some way to make up for lost revenue in this region. I mean, we got to look at what happened when the car tab tax was repealed and find another way to fund local services.
Although we've also seen Ron Sims as county executive make some very poor choices in terms of budget cuts of social services when King County runs into the kind of budget shortfall that they're going to have again this coming year.
Yeah, and there's really nothing left to cut anymore.
All right.
So we'll see.
Well, speaking of cuts, the Port of Seattle made some cuts here this week.
They certainly did. They cut loose 8 Port of Seattle employees in the aviation department, including its top 2 managers. They were fired, and another 4 contract employees were let go, and 7 more were suspended without pay after those 19 people were discovered to have been sending around emails that were, quote, pornographic, racist, sexist, and demeaning material in those emails. And if this sounds vaguely familiar, it's because these emails started just after a scandal last year involving police at the Port of Seattle that were sending around similar emails. And the laugh track in this case should have accompanied the Port of Seattle spokesperson, who said that the incidents, quote, do not indicate any larger troubling pattern. Well, if there were no larger troubling pattern, this wouldn't have been going on precisely at the time that this was in the news, and people started doing this right at the time when the port was allegedly cracking down on this. Now, last year, when the scandal was happening involving the police officers at the Port of Seattle, we criticized the new head of the Port of Seattle for not taking disciplinary action against those police officers. He said he wanted there to be a culture of healing. He wanted to put this behind them, yada, yada, yada. Well, that clearly did not work.
No.
And
in that case, too, the emails involved about a third of the port's police force. So, you know, it would be kind of hard for him to say, okay, you guys are all out of a job.
Well,
there had to be some disciplinary action.
Yeah, he didn't have to necessarily fire them last year, but he did nothing at all.
Yeah.
And so now there's a zero tolerance policy for these type of emails, which I guess is a good thing, but it does raise the question of when there's going to be a zero tolerance policy for, you know, oh, I don't know, cronyism or sweetheart contracts. Or the sort of old boy and old gal network back scratching that is epitomized and continues to epitomize the Port of Seattle. When there's going to be a zero tolerance policy for the sort of, you know, defensive where everything's really okay here kind of reaction to a performance audit by the state auditor's office. Those kind of more serious reforms are what really deserves the zero tolerance policy.
All right, moving on, the BIAW.
Yeah, that's the Business Industry Association of Washington, I believe,
is
the acronym. They are the most powerful right-wing lobby, actually probably the most powerful lobby of any political persuasion in Olympia, and they've been operating behind the scenes for a number of years to elect not just Republican office holders, but also conservative Supreme Court justices. Well, now, 2 former Supreme Court justices, Faith Ireland and Robert Uter, I believe it's pronounced, have announced yesterday.
It's Utter.
Okay. Yeah. They announced yesterday that they are going to be filing a lawsuit against the BIAW as well as an ethics complaint, alleging that the entire Building Industry Association group is acting illegally as a PAC to coordinate and funnel campaign contributions. Now, this is particularly significant in this coming year for a couple of reasons. One of them is being covered exhaustively by the local dailies, which is that contract with the BIAW is a, if not the major backer of Dino Rossi. And they made a big deal of saying that these are people who support Christine Gregoire, yada yada. Well, that's not surprising. But the BIAW is also once again this year trying to run a slate of people to take over the Supreme Court. And they've been doing this for years now and have been successful in a couple of races. Jim Johnson, for example, the former Tim Iman attorney, is now on the Supreme Court. They are trying to get property rights advocates to form a majority on the Supreme Court. So we'll see basically a stealth takeover of the Supreme Court by the same people who brought you Proposition 48 a few years ago.
So that they can carry on a pro-development, anti-environmental agenda. Eventually.
Yeah, these are people who in a recent newsletter compared environmentalists compared environmentalists to Nazis. In fact, talked about wastewater treatment regulations as being the equivalent of Nazi stormtroopers. So it kind of tells you where they're
how
coming
extreme
from.
They are.
Yeah, they're a very extreme group, and they've used that kind of rhetoric repeatedly over the years. And because they have a lot of money, and because
and they use it a lot of the times. They use that rhetoric to raise this money, and they're now using that money in what Ireland and Utter call a secret fund to run TV ads to cut down Christine Gregoire so that hopefully their candidate, Dino Rossi, will win.
Yeah, they're mm-hmm. also very good at dirty tricks. For example, there have been billboards popping up all over eastern Washington that say, don't let Seattle steal the election again.
Yeah.
You know, Rossi for governor. And they don't have any kind of authority line on them saying who they're paid by, but it turns out to be money that came from the BIAW.
And that's against the law here the state of Washington. If you're raising money to run ads like that, you should be registered as a political committee, and you should be providing information on where you collect your money and how it's being spent.
Yeah,
and they're not doing that.
The quote from Ireland has basically said that they're the most egregious violator of state campaign finance law in state political history. And the BIAW really has gotten a free pass from state media, particularly the Seattle Times, basically because they just don't want to take on a very large, very conservative organization. So it's good finally to see a couple of people with the moral and political authority of Supreme Court justices take them on. And if you have a couple of lawyers behind it who are as well-versed in the law as state Supreme Court justices would have to be, you can be fairly confident that they feel pretty good about their legal chances on this one to make it stick.
BIAW, the Building Industry Association of Washington.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you guys said. Okay.
I thought it was.
I thought it was what Jobs said.
Yeah.
I think he said something different. Anyway,
okay.
So moving
on. Roll the tape.
We'll get our engineer working on that. Okay,
there's an engineer
moving
here.
On. Yeah, he's just in the other room.
Where's he hiding?
Yeah, you didn't notice the train wreck.
All right, we have a very short period of time left. Cap and trades.
Yeah, some good news on the environmental front here regionally. The Western Climate Initiative released their proposed plan for a cap and trade system to limit greenhouse gases. The Western Climate Initiative includes the states of Arizona, California, Montana, New Mexico, Oregon, Utah, and our own lovely Washington state. Plus, it includes four provinces of Canada, British Columbia, Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec. And I think I had read just a week or two ago that Ottawa is joining as well, eventually. And that covers...
Oh, you mean the federal government?
Huh?
You mean the federal government of Canada is joining?
No, I think it's the city of Ottawa.
Oh, okay.
Wants to
because
get involved
I was
well.
Going to say, this, Ottawa is not a province.
No, I know. The city of Ottawa is getting involved in it as well. So that covers roughly 20% of the U.S. population as well as a major portion of Canada. This is the first regional grouping in the U.S. to announce a cap-and-trade system, any kind of system, really, to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And there are 14 more North American states and provinces in the three countries, U.S., Mexico, and Canada, that are tracking the Western Climate Initiative process and are looking at adopting it for themselves as well. And it's widely viewed as a model for an eventual national system. Or a continent-wide system that includes all three countries. So, but it's still in draft form, of course. The main bone of contention among people negotiating the plan is the trade portion of the system. How will credits be allocated? Should credits be bought and sold on an open market, et cetera, et cetera?
All right.
So,
Moving on, the salmon returning.
Yeah, there was a report this week of a record number of sockeye salmon returning to the Columbia River system. It's the best run since 1955, showing that, of course, the fact that you spill water over dams, as has been done in the last 2 years to wash juvenile salmon out to sea, has a major impact on how many salmon return to spawn in your rivers. No surprise there, although there are still folks, believe it or not, including the Building Industry Association of Washington, who are arguing that spilling water over the dams makes no difference with salmon runs. Clearly, they're wrong. It also brings up the issue of what would actually happen if we did remove those four dams from the Lower Snake River. How many more salmon would return? I think there would be no controversy over the fact that there should be no controversy over the fact that would mean a complete revival of much of the salmon run that's disappeared from the Snake River.
All right, moving on to National and the EPA.
Yeah, speaking of environmental protection, a couple of items this week on greenhouse gases and the EPA's role therein. This is a report came out this week from the EPA's Inspector General, and you'll be shocked, I am sure, to find out that according to the Inspector General of the EPA, very few of the industry are volunteering to adopt the Bush administration's approach of voluntary cutbacks in emissions of greenhouse gases. There are 11 different programs, 10 of which dated to the Clinton administration, which are supposedly supposed to inspire industry to voluntarily cut back on greenhouse gases. They're going almost completely unused and, of course, probably unpromoted as well by the Bush EPA. And also, in terms of the Bush EPA, this is in the department of being unclear on the concept. There was Senate testimony this week in a committee that the EPA tried to evade greenhouse gas regulations for power plants by trying to define CO2 from cars as somehow being chemically different from the CO2 that is emitted from power plants. These are folks that just don't have a very clear understanding of, oh, I don't know, middle school chemistry.
Yeah. I took chemistry in high school. I don't know about these people.
Well, I think this even, I was going to say high school, but this even predates high school.
Yeah, really. I think you even get that concept when you're younger.
Right.
Yes.
Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the House passed a bill this week to deal with the housing crisis. That bill is up before the Senate and is likely to pass today. The question is, will this bill actually help anyone? And the jury's still out on that. My take on it is that no, it's not going to help a whole heck of a lot. The key provision, which a $300 billion $300 billion from the U.S. Treasury to nationalize a portion of these failing mortgages, is really just a tiny drop in the bucket. It's called the HOPE program, and it's supposed to help up to 400,000 homeowners refinance from private mortgages with adjustable rates into government mortgage. But there's some big crucial limits to who can take advantage of the program that's going to prevent most people who are in trouble from being able to utilize it. The biggest problem is that it's voluntary on the part of their private lenders, whether or not people can actually take advantage of the program. And if a lender can get more money by foreclosing on your house and selling it on the market, especially in a market like here in Seattle where prices are still pretty good, then lenders are going to do that. They're not going to let you take advantage of the program.
One of those voluntary programs again.
Yeah, and then even if you're in a housing market that's doing poorly, it's not going to probably be for you either, because lenders are going to have to take a big write-down on the value of the original mortgage. HOPE will only write mortgages for about 90% of the current market value of your home. So if your home has dropped in value, that means your private lender is going to have to take a big write-down. And because the program's voluntary, a lot of lenders aren't going to do that. They're going to say, well, we'll foreclose and keep the house and let it sit until prices go up. You know, that's another option for them. So it's a question of, will anyone want to take advantage of it? In addition, people who have already gotten a foreclosure notice on their home won't qualify. You have to be at risk of, but not yet in the foreclosure process in order to do it. So
So the millions of people who've already been foreclosed, there's nothing for them.
Yeah, and it's only supposed to help about 400,000 people. Well, if we look at the number of people who got foreclosure notice in the second quarter of this year, it was above 700,000. So it's really just a tiny drop in the bucket. And there's no real incentive to make private lenders participate. So I don't think it's going to help much at all. The other part of the plan that was controversial was an unlimited line of credit to prop up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, that might be necessary to avoid the total collapse of the credit markets, but that means taxpayers are going to be on the hook for the low estimate is $25 billion. That's the Congressional Budget Office estimate. But I've seen estimates from private economists as high as $1 trillion in bailout money for Fannie and Freddie.
All right, just a few minutes left. Barack Obama's trip overseas.
Yeah, the Barack Obama adulation world tour is just about to wrap up. A couple of significant things out of it. One is that foreign leaders seem to be falling over themselves to all but coming out and endorsing Barack Obama for president, which tells you a lot about the bankruptcy of the current regime and how John McCain is viewed as being an extension of the current regime. In particular, Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, came out and essentially endorsed Barack's timetable for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. We also had Obama in Afghanistan signaling a major commitment of troops to that conflict, and that's something that people need to start paying attention to, that both Obama and McCain have signaled that they want to be in Afghanistan and at war there for the long haul without any kind of real national debate as to whether A, that war is winnable, and B, whether we want to be there, and if so, to what purpose. We need to start paying more attention to Afghanistan.
All right. Other info on Iraq?
Yeah, the Kurdish president, Jalal Talabani, vetoed the election law this week that would have called for fall provincial elections. It looks like those elections now are not going to happen. And then the State Department Inspector General is investigating whether the State Department was illicitly encouraging backdoor deals between the government of Iraq and oil companies. According to the Bush administration, those deals aren't supposed to happen until after an oil law is passed. But apparently behind the scenes, they were negotiating for oil companies to be making money off of Iraq anyway. Gee, imagine that.
Yeah.
And Israel-Palestine?
Yeah, this also was an outgrowth of the Obama trip that once again we had the U.S. media portraying meeting with Palestinian and Israeli leaders, but it wasn't met with the actual elected government of Palestine, that being Hamas. People in this country and the media seem to be pretending that Hamas doesn't exist, and guess what? They do, and they actually are the elected representatives of the Palestinian people. We need to start dealing with them on that basis.
All right. And briefly, Pakistan.
Yeah. Amnesty International report came out this week saying that Pakistan has disappeared hundreds of, quote, terrorism suspects over the past several years, as young as 9 years old. And a lot of that happened under Musharraf, but it continued to happen under the current government, even in recent weeks and months. And the really telling part of this was that a lot of those folks, the Amnesty accused the Pakistani government of torture of these suspects as well, but they were also accusing them of extraordinary rendition. What horrible third country were they exporting them to that practices torture that's even worse than Pakistan's? The United States. We're now the country that other totalitarian regimes export their prisoners to in order to be tortured. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
All right, and finally, briefly, events.
Yeah, one event this week, the Wednesday, the military or anti-military regatta will welcome Seafair's naval presence at the waterfront at Pier 66 Wednesday at 1 o'clock, and I'm sure they'll be setting up a no-protest zone, just like China's announced to do for the Beijing Olympics. I wonder where they got that idea.
Yeah.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. We are in the middle of our summer fun drive, so anything you can do to help would be welcome. It's at bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, libraries, places where you get free periodicals. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, any of that kind of good stuff, drop us an email. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.